From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn about employee rights during this pandemic and how they can navigate an evolving workplace. Then we learn how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting the meat industry and what this means for our food system in the U.S.
This poses a dilemma for them. They have competing interests. One interest is in to run their business. Another interest is to provide food for society. And a third interest is to take care of their workforce, because they can't do either of the first two if they don't have a workforce.
Plus, a tribute to improvisation master and UW-Madison jazz instructor Joan Wildman, who passed away last month.
I think everybody improvises every day. I think everybody has the opportunity to improvise very well if they work very hard at it. I think it's an attitude. As I say, it can be your whole life.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's clear we're living in unusual times. The COVID-19 pandemic has fundamentally changed how we socialize and how we work. For some, particularly essential workers, this has made it difficult to navigate an evolving workplace with employee protections in the limelight. Employers have been giving more leeway in the questions they can ask their employees, which raises concerns about accountability and potential discrimination. Barbara Zabala is an expert in health and wellness law, as well as the co-director of the Master's in Health Administration program at UW-Milwaukee's College of Health Sciences. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about employee rights during this pandemic.
So this seems like a small thing, but this question can have really big implications. Are employers allowed to ask you how you're feeling?
Yes, they can ask how you're feeling, especially right now with the pandemic. It's been declared officially a pandemic. The Americans with Disabilities Act is the law that would normally, that would apply in situations of employment and questions relating to an employee's health and illness. So in a pandemic, there's a provision within the Americans with Disabilities Act that loosens a little bit the restrictions that would otherwise apply, that of what employers can and can't do in terms of questioning about health or taking your temperature. In non-pandemic times, that would be prohibited. But in pandemic times, there's a provision called direct threat that gives employers a little bit more leeway in what they can do as far as asking questions and taking medical exams, which temperature taking, for example, would qualify as a medical exam. They're able to do that in these situations. And it's because, you know, it's not just about that individual and their fear of possible discrimination. There's also a more global need to protect other workers in the workplace because of the pandemic.
So you mentioned, when we have a pandemic, some of these restrictions are loosened. What are some examples of restrictions that would otherwise be in place outside of a pandemic?
So in a pandemic situation, employers can ask employees who are either visibly sick or say that they're sick, whether they have certain symptoms, you know, that they know might be an indication that they could have the virus. Those kinds of questions, that probing that you're going to be doing if someone is visibly sick or says that they're calling in sick, you wouldn't do that in a pre-pandemic kind of situation. You wouldn't start digging into, have you taken your temperature and are you feeling like you're coughing and is it a dry cough? And you, all those kind of more detailed questions you wouldn't want to do in a pre-pandemic time. And you wouldn't also take temperatures. You wouldn't ask that employees, you know, before they step into the workplace, get their temperature taken or ask them a series of health questions before letting them enter the workplace. That just would be a big no-no. So now, because of the pandemic and the direct threat standard, you have that ability to do that. You still have to be careful that you don't discriminate against employees based on any disability or perceived disability, because that still applies. And you still have to provide reasonable accommodations to employees who need them and who request them. That is still an ADA requirement. But you are able to ask for a little bit more information than you otherwise would, or be able to take temperatures in the workplace.
If you're someone who's tested positive for COVID-19, is that something that you need to tell your company?
Do you need to tell your company? Not under the Americans with Disabilities Act. You would be violating guidelines, actually, by the CDC or the president's order or the stay-at-home order on the state level, or maybe even some local orders that say if you are have the virus, you know, stay home, practice social distancing and all that. And so you would be in violation of those guidelines and or orders, but it wouldn't be a law, a statutory law like the ADA, where you're required to report. You know, the ADA would say if you do have it and you do report it to your employer, then your employer is obligated to reasonably accommodate you. And now under the new laws that were passed by Congress in March, the Families First Coronavirus Act, you would be eligible for paid sick leave, for example.
Going back to the, you know, testing positive, going to your company, I've heard from other companies that if you have a spouse who has tested positive, if you have children or anybody in your home who has tested positive, they want to know. Do you have to tell them? Similarly, if you're someone who is tested positive, do you have to tell them if there's somebody in your home who has tested positive? Because these are things that companies are asking for. And I think some people are afraid that they will be discriminated against as a result of it, or stigmatized, certainly.
You know, that's a great question. Again, the laws that we normally deal with in employment wouldn't require you to say that to your employer, but your employer might have a policy, at least right now, that they've implemented, asking all employees who've tested positive or have been exposed to someone who's tested positive to inform them of that information, you know, for purposes of keeping other workers safe and being able to take action to keep the workplace safe. So if you didn't want to tell the employer, you could be accused of violating a company policy. And, you know, typically those policies are tied to a disciplinary policy for violating other policies. And so you could be subject to discipline. If you feel, though, that you've been targeted for an improper reason, like because of your age or because of your race or because of your gender, some protected class, or because you have a disability, the laws that do exist, civil rights laws, would be there to protect you from any retaliatory action like termination or demotion or some other treatment that others would not have faced if they, you know, who were similarly situated.
Yeah. So kind of on the flip side of this, I've heard concerns from people who work for companies where they know someone has been sickened. They are essential workers, so they have to keep coming into work. Not the people who are sickened, but rather the other employees. But the company won't say who got sick, who has been infected. And that concerns people who are going back into these facilities going, well, is it somebody I work with? Is it somebody nearby? Can companies name names when it comes to who's been infected?
No, they can't. That has been clear from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, which is the federal agency that enforces compliance with laws like the ADA. And the ADA, we talked about it earlier, where, you know, the restrictions are a little bit loosened during a pandemic like we're having, as far as what employers can ask of employees or do for employees. But one of the things that the EEOC has stressed is just because you can find out information that in other times you wouldn't be able to find out, you still have the obligation to keep that information confidential. So if you know someone, an employee who has the virus, you're not allowed to disclose who that is, but you should be following CDC guidelines and OSHA guidelines and trying to tell people who may have had interactions with that employee that they could be at risk, but you are not to name names. They do not want that. That would violate the confidentiality requirement under the ADA.
Okay. So, you know, you talked about this a bit before, paid time off. There have been a lot of questions about this, particularly for workers who generally aren't guaranteed paid time off. Right now, is there a requirement for all companies to offer it?
Companies with 500 or fewer employees, so larger companies, Congress excluded those from this paid sick leave, 2 weeks paid sick leave requirement, because they thought that larger companies, more than 500 employees, would already have paid leave policies and that employees would benefit from those existing paid leave policies, whereas smaller employers, defined again by Congress as 500 or fewer employees, are more likely to not already have paid leave policies. And so they wanted to make sure that employees who work for these smaller organizations had 2 weeks, 10 working days of paid sick leave if they met certain criteria. And it's not open to everybody. You know, if you're deciding to self-quarantine just because you're worried and you don't want to go back to work, or you're just afraid to get exposed to a virus situation, that's not qualifying. You can't get paid leave for that situation. So you have to meet one of the five tests in order to benefit from that paid leave.
What are these five tests?
You have to be subject to a quarantine order by the government or by a healthcare professional, or your child's school has closed or daycare has closed. There's a fifth category that's kind of a catch-all that has not been implemented at all by the Department of Health and Human Services yet. And I believe the other one is if you are caring for someone who is under an order to quarantine by the government or a healthcare professional.
Okay, so some companies are requiring employees to provide, you know, a positive test. I've heard from people who have said, you know, my company doesn't want to give me the paid time off because I don't have a test. But of course, access to these tests is pretty limited still. Even for people who have symptoms, it's hard to get these. Can they require that? Can they require you to get a positive test in order to take this time off?
That's not a qualifying factor under the FCRA, under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. It's if you're subject to a quarantine order by a health professional, and there's no language that the quarantine has to do with a positive test. It's the order is by a health professional or the government. And so obviously having a test reinforces that, but I think employees could argue that my health professional is requiring me to stay home. And as long as they can present a letter, although the government has also said don't expect letters because the health community is very overwhelmed right now and it may be very difficult for them to respond to every request for a letter. So one of the mantras that I've seen by all the government agencies that are involved with this pandemic response, which includes HHS, Department of Labor, EEOC, Treasury, and the CDC, of course, all have asked employers to be flexible during this time. Be flexible in your policies and try to be understanding with employee needs and fears and anxieties. And I think that's important because, you know, even though employees may not have the legal tools, the fact that, you know, they are legitimately scared and anxious about what's going on is important for an employer to recognize as what are the long-term effects if you're not responding well to those employee fears. You know, how is that going to affect your ability to recruit, retain, and your reputation in the community, in addition to any possible lawsuits that, you know, employees might, once they're feeling up to it, want to file because they feel like they've been wronged in some way. Maybe negligence, you know, an inability for the employer to follow guidelines, which do say if you can work from home, work from home. So, you know, those are important considerations for the long term as well that employers should take into account when they're making these decisions.
Yeah. So some people have had a very hard time collecting their pay after they've been sick, even if they've been approved for this paid time off. What kind of recourse do they have if their company is stalling on their payment for whatever reason? Do you know?
Well, certainly they can file a complaint with the Department of Workforce Development in Wisconsin. That's our agency that deals with wage claims. You know, from the employer side, they are able to get a tax credit for being to fund these paid leave requirements. So they do have a means that the federal government created to finance paid leave requests. And so certainly, you know, if they're requesting the tax credit but not giving the employee the money, that would be fraud. And so that's something that, you know, I think Treasury would want to know, the Department of Treasury, since they're the ones who are administering these tax credits that employers should be taking advantage of in order to finance the paid leave requests.
Yeah. To sum things up a bit, what's important to remember when you're an employee who's trying to navigate this very unusual situation in the workplace?
Yeah, so I would say for employees, you know, your fears are legitimate. I mean, there's a lot of confusing information out there, and you should definitely pay attention to your health needs. And if you feel anxious about returning to the workplace because, for example, you have an underlying medical condition that may, you know, compromise you even more than someone who doesn't have such a condition, that you should tell your employer about that. And they are required to work with you to find a way to address that under the ADA. And I think there's a lot of people out there who may have underlying medical conditions that their employer has no idea about, which they shouldn't, because, you know, there's no need to know if your employees have diabetes or underlying cardiovascular issues. But those issues do make you more vulnerable to the virus. And if you are worried about that, tell your employer, and you know that, you know, there's an obligation on their part to work with you to find a reasonable accommodation so that you can feel safe.
Yeah. Well, Barbara Zabawa, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You're welcome.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor and co-director of the Masters in Health Administration program at UW-Milwaukee's College of Health Sciences. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up next, we learn how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting the meat industry. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Outbreaks in the meat industry are not new. In the early 90s, mad cow disease was a trade problem that affected the entire industry that halted the sale of beef worldwide. Then, a large outbreak of avian influenza in early 2013 was a pathogenic problem that led to the euthanization of thousands of birds. Coronavirus, however, is entirely different in that it affects the segments of the beef industry where there is a high concentration of people in small places where the opportunity of transmission is increased. Meat plants have workers, already in dangerous roles, at greater risk of getting COVID-19 standing elbow to elbow on the job. The outbreak of the disease in meat plants has caused a disruption in food supply and beef prices to rise. Despite President Trump using executive power to reopen plants, doing so puts managers in a tough position as almost 5,000 COVID-19 cases were reported at meat processing facilities across the nation. Dan Schaefer is an emeritus professor of animal sciences at UW-Madison, and he joins me to help shed light on the problems the beef industry faces today. He starts by explaining where Wisconsin companies fall under this dilemma.
They have competing interests. One interest is in to run their business. Another interest is to provide food for society. And a third interest is to take care of their workforce, because they can't do either of the first two if they don't have a workforce.
This deals with the setup of the plants and where workers are. So can you explain the physical setup of the plants and how workers are spaced and used in production process that has contributed to the spread of coronavirus?
Well, many of the plants in the meat industry are not new. They were built, some parts of them were built 50 years ago. And then in some cases, remodeling has occurred and new additions have been made. So depending upon the physical space available in the building and the nature of the business to be conducted, obviously the plant management needs to decide how to conduct the process of, in this case, harvesting animals and converting them to meat products. Obviously, they have to do all of this indoors, because if they were to do any of these processes outdoors, the food production process would be subject to environmental contamination, which would raise food safety concerns. And it would increase spoilage of the food and reduce the shelf life of the food items, the meat items. And then it's a matter of fitting all the workers in line to do the array of steps involved in rendering the animal unconscious, removing the blood from the animal's body, and then step by step doing the disassembly process, resulting in the end in a raw material which then has to be chilled, where in the case of cattle, it is held for 24 and most commonly 48 hours. Then it's been chilled and it is now a less favorable habitat for microorganisms to proliferate on. And then it goes through a further disassembly process, resulting ultimately in a meat cut that's in a vacuum package, which goes into a box. And then that box goes into refrigerated storage or frozen storage if it's going to be long-term storage.
So during this process, what kind of protection gear do workers normally wear for each stage of the assembly process? And how long did it take for Wisconsin companies to actively start not just distributing, but requiring more PPE for their workers that was for coronavirus specifically and not their everyday wear?
Well, with regards to the normal PPE, of course, their principal concern is to prevent injuries. And that is the longstanding, well-established plant safety protocol that any of the processing plants have in place. What the coronavirus does is to raise a different kind of safety concern. And now we're talking about a disease that's transmitted through the air. So all of a sudden now the airspace around a worker, and not simply the knife space, let's say, around a worker is important. First of all, the workers would, depending upon their job, they would be wearing something to protect themselves from injury by sharp objects. And they would also be garbed in white clothing, which is always used by food production people, because it is able to be washed and dirt on the uniform can be observed. So all of that was done in the interest of to prevent microbiological or minimize microbiological contamination of food products. Now, in addition to this, there needs to be this sort of airspace consideration. And so ventilation comes into play in terms of air changes in the space. Of course, if one is blowing a lot of air through a space that is intended to be refrigerated, that certainly increases the demand on the refrigeration system. Then there's the proximity issue. And so I'm sure what they are all considering right now, there's been some guidance put out by CDC about plexiglass shields to prevent side-to-side contamination and then avoid working across the table from someone, or if workers will be across the table from one another, to put up some sort of plexiglass in between But the challenge now is to spread workers out and accomplish all the same steps, but in more space. But there's a space constraint because it all has to fit within the available space, the available floor plan of the building. Maybe one can envision a worker who does more than one job in order to get all the jobs done by fewer workers. Or there's been some thought that the production system in the future, when the plants come back online, may be slower. But that might be a thought that simply reflects that they're short-staffed. It's a real dilemma. And so I would never want the public to think that plant management is inconsiderate of their labor force, because that is illogical. The work doesn't get done if you don't have people to do it, and the people that are doing those jobs don't want to come to work and take a risk of becoming sick or ill. So how does one get the work done while assuring your workforce, your employees, that they are going to be safe?
With companies trying to manage federal government guidelines and their own judgment and their own capabilities from building to building on what would be the best way to continue operations, how is this affecting the supply chain?
Yeah, the impact on the supply chain goes as follows. So in the beginning of this, when it began to express its effects on the food plants, on the meat plants, then of course there was the recognition that some in the workforce were positive. Well, then it didn't take long for the public health officials to pay attention to the fact that these meat processing plants, and for that matter, could be any other plant where workers are working close together, are hotspots. They're hotspots not because the plant themselves is the origin of the virus. It's because the workers who are out in their families, even if they're sheltering in place, through their own networks, they have the opportunity to pick up the virus. And if they're asymptomatic and they come to work, then it's in the plants. So then there's a flurry of positive cases. So then the plants, the workforce doesn't want to come to work. They'll call in sick, which they certainly should do. And the plant can't get its work done. It can't really ensure the safety. So they say, we got to stop here. We got to consider our situation. Sometimes there have even been outbreaks of the virus among management. I mean, nobody's immune to this, not anyone in the country. So the plant shuts down. Of course, they're going to clean the plant. And there's advisory guidance now in terms of sanitization chemistries that are effective against the virus. From my limited understanding of the sanitation chemistries, it's the same kind of chemistries that have been used all along to kill the bacterial problems in plants to ensure food safety. Then anyone who's in a leadership role faces this question, okay, well, we need to get back in operation. The president wants us to be back in the operation. In fact, he doesn't really need to tell us to operate. We want to operate, but how do we bring our workforce back in? And we know that in order to bring the workforce back in, we have to be able to ensure them that they will be safe. So ideally, one would like to be able to give them a vaccination, but we don't have a vaccine. So now one would like to test the workforce. That would be a big help. At least you would admit everyone into the plant who is negative. But when the workforce leaves the plant, they go back out into the community where we don't have a control on the virus. So now we're talking about a huge demand for testing capability. Well, we don't have that. So the risk continues. We can take temperatures of workforce. We can try to detect symptoms, but it's going to be an ongoing challenge. We're going to learn now when society comes back in motion just what the recurrence of infections will be.
Are you aware of Wisconsin plants that have temporarily shut down, are currently shut down, or are starting to implement these test point protocols, essentially, to try and make it a secure workplace?
Yep, you bet. So the JBS Packerland plant in Green Bay was shut down for a time. I saw a photo taken of American Foods Group in Green Bay, and they were testing workforce for symptoms before they entered the plant. Well, you can think of the plants within Wisconsin, but it's really not a statewide thing. It's a nationwide thing. And so one of the plants is owned by a nationwide company. There's a Smithfield plant in Cudahy that's been shut down for a couple of weeks. This is a national problem. This isn't just a state problem. Because the meat that's produced by the plants here in Wisconsin, it would be safe to assume that it goes all over the nation and it goes to our trading partners around the world.
This industry obviously relies on a lot of people to do repetitive, careful work in every step of this process. Do you think this situation will encourage more investment in any possible automation? And, you know, can any part of this really be automated safely?
The answer would be yes. There will be thought as to how to probably minimize the number of people or the number of jobs that are needed to be filled in order to get the work done. So automation will be on their minds. I mean, and it has been on their minds because even before the pandemic, repetitive motion injuries have been a concern of the industry. It's another example of where the pandemic will spur creativity for ways to get the job done while minimizing this new set of risks that's known to us now.
The average person eats around 106 pounds of red meat per year, you know, according to estimations. But with the virus affecting chain supply, raising meat prices, limiting meat availability, you know, what do you think are the long-term implications? Because, you know, we can obviously survive without red meat. What do you think will be the larger impact?
Given the absence of beef sales through food services and the surge in grocery store purchases, the thought is that total beef sales are still probably down about 10 or 15% from normal. I think that it will take a while for the market to find the new normal, but I don't really foresee that the appetite for meat will disappear. The sad thing in the present situation is that the animals that are harvest ready are having to be euthanized if there is not a place that will harvest and process them. So as you may have read, there was a pork plant in Worthington, Minnesota that opened up with a skeleton staff. And the purpose of that pork plant was simply going to be to euthanize pigs that are harvest ready, but they weren't going to be processing those pigs into pork. They were just going to be landfilling those pigs or in some way disposing of their bodies. And they were expecting that they would do about 13,000 pigs a day, just for no value. Obviously, this is because our food system in the U.S. is a just-in-time food system. All of the animal biology is managed in a way so that the animal reaches a harvest-ready endpoint, which is determined by market preferences, which are influenced by consumer interests. So when we have a disruption because one-third of the harvest capacity is offline, for cattle, we have some opportunity for them to grow to heavier weights, to backlog the cattle and leave them out on pasture now for summer for a longer period of time. So feedlot placements in the U.S. are down. Cattle that are in feedlots are being held on feed for a longer period of time. So when they do come to market, they will be heavier. There will be more beef on the market. Anyway, the consequence for those in the production sector is devastating because the cost of feeding animals for no additional value in the gain is very expensive, and it is emotionally draining for people who produce animals to see those animals not fulfill a purpose for humankind.
Right, which has been a big issue surrounding the meat industry. Do you think that this could create long-term changes for a more sustainable way to humanely raise and slaughter meat?
So locally produced food is certainly a viable means of food production. It is a more expensive means of food production. So those products cost more because there are not the economies of scale realized in those production systems. All along, if society is willing to pay more for food, many more options become available. But the U.S. society has paid 8 to 10% of their disposable, or spent 8 to 10% of their disposable income on food, and that's been great because then there was all that other disposable income to spend on other things. Alternative means of food production, they're always in play. No one should ever think that the food production system is static. Alternatives get evaluated, and when certain alternatives have merit for mainstream food production, then they move into mainstream. The economy of scale influence on our society is widespread.
All right. Well, Dan Schaefer, thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on the topic.
My pleasure. I'm enthused to have society need to take an interest in where their food comes from.
Dan Schaefer is an emeritus professor of animal sciences at UW-Madison. We'll take one last break and then return with a tribute to improvisation master and UW-Madison jazz instructor, Joan Wildman. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The modern piano keyboard has 88 keys, and the late Joan Wildman was a master of all of them. Her improvisations would go from low, low bass notes to the very high upper registers. She played stride, blues, bebop, eighth notes, quarter notes, intervals, and sometimes the inner strings and sides of the piano, not just the keys. Wildman taught jazz at UW-Madison for 24 years before retiring in 2002. Before and after leaving UW, she led trios, quartets, quintets, and also performed solo piano, often accompanying it with her own animations. Wildman died last month. Her improvisation transcended music, coloring how she viewed everything from nature to sports. WUWM's Mayan Silver and her brother Eitan were her students and friends. Mayan has this tribute, including a portion of an interview with Wildman from 2016.
Joan Wildman was a force of nature. To watch her play was to witness someone who lived for creativity. She was always inventive and never settled. Here's the sunny portion of a composition of Joan's she wrote shortly before her death called Both Sides of the Street. She wrote in an email, "We can all conjure up what the sunny side of the street looks like, but what about the other side? Which is more important? Do they balance out?" But Joan also knew about the other side, like battling cancer. She knew about saying no to a drug that might prolong her life because it would make her hands and fingers go numb and prevent her from playing the piano that was so much a part of her. Joan grew up in Nebraska and started playing by ear when she was really little. By the time she was 16, when she actually went off to college, she'd heard and loved Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins. As a summer job in college at age 17, Joan started playing jazz in a nightclub, six nights a week. But she missed Beethoven and finished her degree in classical music. Here I am talking to Joan in 2016.
Whoa, I never knew this stuff about you.
Okay. Life is long, yeah?
Joan was always doing some sort of jazz playing and then mentioned this, something else I didn't know.
But it really wasn't until, I guess it wasn't until moving to Michigan at one point, Central Michigan University, I worked there, played there, and I had the really wonderful opportunity to play with the Duke Ellington Band when Ellington got sick. And that just sort of, again, was another spurring me on kind of thing.
This is how she describes her pursuit of both classical and jazz.
I was trying to be a piano player, you know, for a long time. Still am. But at the point where, you know, there's a point in your life where you have to really learn a lot of techniques. So I was really concerned. I was playing some concertos with some orchestras at my schools and things like that. And just learning how to play Bach fugues and do them well and do solo recitals and things like that. And I had to learn a lot of really good piano technique, just learn the instrument, not just diddle around with my right hand like I still think too many jazz players do, but use both hands to play the instrument and know what you're doing with both hands, all 10 fingers at the same time. And that's, you know, takes a lot of work. And so in that regard, I guess I was probably trying, I was more focused on the classical part than on the jazz part, but the jazz part was always there.
We're listening to a piece of Joan's called 3x19 from her 1992 album Inside Out. The jazz part became more a reflection of what Joan wanted to express while doing her doctoral dissertation on aleatory music. That's a type of music where some of it is, quote, left to chance. But Joan asked one of the practitioners of aleatory music about what to do if the composers, in this case a guy named Barney Childs, directions say one thing, like to play very softly and only eighth notes, but she feels the music requires loud and fast notes, for instance.
What should I do? Should I rely on my musical instincts, or do I have to rely on that notated little card that Barney Childs had written out? He said, you got to rely on what Barney Childs says at that moment, which I probably knew he would say. But at that moment, I realized, no, it's not aleatory piano music for me, it's jazz. It's improvisation rather than aleatory music. And that was the clincher. It narrowed myself down to just improvisation and the music that I would write that would promote improvisation.
What is improvisation to you?
Just about everything. Just about everything. It's a way of life.
Tell me a little bit about what you mean by that.
It's how I approach the day. It's how I react with people. It's how I raise my children. It's how I cook food. Obviously, it's how I play music. It's how I look at nature. All of that.
And so what would be an example of an improvisation that occurred, you know, this week or last week?
Well, last night I just finished mastering this little cut that we did with my quintet. And so there were a lot of possibilities of ways I could master this particular cut and how I could use these different elements to serve the piece better. And I just decided to figure out ways that maybe I could use this thing going here, and what would happen if I did that, and wouldn't that be fun if I did that? And I'm talking about subtle little things like how much reverb to use, taking reverb off another part of an instrument, just doing things like that, and trying to, not having any preconceived ideas about how it should end or how it should work, but just exploring things. Improvisation is really exploration.
And so with life, like, how do you approach exploration with improvisation in mind with things going on in your life? Like, let's say nature, for instance.
My favorite thing about nature is, I've talked about this a lot of times before, is just looking at a tree and watching the leaves and thinking of each leaf as the breeze goes through the tree leaves, how each branch full of leaves are going to have a particular rhythm, and then another branch is going to have a different tempo and probably different rhythms as well when the breeze hits them. They're all different, and so you have polyrhythms going on all the time with these wonderful, with these leaf movements, and I just I think that's so wonderful. And you can just hear how it develops. And sometimes if you look at the higher branches, it's going a little bit faster than the lower branches. And so you can just imagine sounds doing that at the same time you're watching the leaves grow. And it would be like a wonderful opportunity if you could actually play those sounds that the movement makes as the tree leaves move.
So the improvisation in the world can affect how you interpret the world, sort of?
Yes, exactly.
Do you think that improvisation is something, some people have an affinity towards it? Do you think that it's something that can be taught, or do you have to have some sort of connection to improvisation in your soul or your personality or something?
I think everybody improvises every day. I think everybody has the opportunity to improvise very well if they work very hard at it. I think it's an attitude. As I say, it can be your whole life. But just the way you walk down the street. Right now, you and I have been improvising because I've not known what questions you were going to ask me. And you probably didn't know what questions you were going to ask me either, you know. And it's just a way of doing things, just walking down the street. What store are you going to look into? What store window are you going to look into? How fast are you going to walk? Are you going to stop and look around a little bit before you take the next step? Or what are you going to do? Everything we do basically is pretty much, only robots are pre-programmed.
How do you think that improvisation like that frees you?
Oh, it's so obvious, I think, how it frees you, because you have the opportunity to do all sorts of things that otherwise you wouldn't be able to. I mean, just today, for example, you were coming over, we were going to have lunch, right? And that was going to be a lot of fun, and I thought I would take you out for lunch somewhere. And then I got this note from you that saying, oh, you were going to bring over this, whatever. And I thought, oh, well, that's going to be fun. So I went down to the store and bought something and brought it home. So we didn't go out for lunch, but it was just as much fun going to the store and buying something and bringing it home and enjoying what you brought as well. In fact, it was probably a lot more fun than had we gone out to a restaurant. That's improvisation on a very recent level.
And do you think, actually, I think I was talking to my brother about this, and we were talking about, he remembered that you said about, what was it that you said about Brett Favre versus Aaron Rodgers?
Oh, I've said a lot of things. I don't know if I want to repeat any of the ones.
No, but you just talked about Brett Favre in relation to his improv. I think you mentioned that as a quarterbacking. And I think that's something that a lot of people might understand who may not actually experience jazz from an intellectual standpoint. They might understand that.
Well, Brett Favre just made things up as he went along sometimes. He knew all the techniques that he had to use. I mean, he studied his craft beautifully, as Aaron Rodgers has done as well. But I have a feeling in the back of my mind that Aaron Rodgers just hates to improvise. And he's gotten a little bit more interested in improvisation when he tries to get out of the pocket, when he feels like he has to a lot sooner. But for the longest time, he just has not wanted to try to do something different than what was originally called for. Whereas Brett Favre, he didn't care. You know, he would throw the ball. There might be somebody open, there might not be. But if they're not open, they might get open really fast if it's Brett Favre. And usually the guy would catch it.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And so with politics going on right now in American government and everything, do you see a way that government could be, you know, improved by a jazz viewpoint?
Absolutely. I think one of the things about jazz music and the democracy about it is playing in a group and then having people say what they want to say and to be polite about it. The other people in the band listen to what they have said. And they wait until the other person has finished saying it, and then they come in and say what they want to say. And that would be so helpful in our political situation today if we really had a chance to sit down and listen to what someone else was doing and then waited until they finished before we started saying something else. So that would be a big thing.
Good, this is recording. I freaked out for a minute and thought it might not be recording. But you know what? Jazz would help you let go of that and move on and start afresh, right? Because you have to play the music and let go of it. Can you talk about that a little bit, that experience?
Well, I think, my own experience certainly has been like that. But as far as what other people might realize, it's just looking at Miles Davis and how he was able to play and let go and then start a new style and let go. And his whole dimension of playing with Charlie Parker and doing bebop, and then the stuff, even live at Fillmore West, for example, is one of my favorite things that he did later in life. What a difference, a completely different kind of style that he did. And of course, all the modal things that he did in the middle. He was happiest, I think, when he was able to create something new instead of just going back. In fact, he often said about how it wasn't interesting to play the old things over and over and over again, but rather to implement a new way of looking at something, fresh way of looking at something.
Joan herself was a master of this. She was always able to think of new ideas and not play cliches. She was inspired by the musicians she played with, toying with things as simple as an interval or maybe a mood of some kind. She says she always felt like an individual in the long history of jazz creators.
It's nice to listen to other people and then turn them off and go look inside yourself and do something. That's what I think. And it's like the saxophone. You know, you don't want every alto player sounding the same, you know? And then all this time, for the last maybe 20 years, you still have people trying to sound like John Coltrane. And, I mean, that's just a waste of time. John Coltrane died, you know, and he's got a wonderful bunch of music for us to listen to. But you're you, and you live now, and movements come and go, but you are now, and you are you, and you need to create your own thing that says something.
Wow, that's really cool. That's really cool. And you think that that lesson can translate over any undertaking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Be not afraid. You know, if you fail at something, if it doesn't work out, well, try something else. That's all. Just keep trying to do something that you feel is right and important and makes sense to you.
That was Joan Wildman, the late jazz pianist and UW-Madison music professor, speaking with WUWM's Mayon Silver in 2016. You're hearing a piece called 302 from Joan's 2015 album with bass and flute player Joe Fonda called Conversations. Wildman died in April. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.